I want to welcome Agile XRM to the podcast. I've known the people at Agile XRM for the past 12 years. I've seen how their business process management tool can add massive value to complex organizational processes in sectors such as finance and government. If you have complex processes or a need for dialogues on the Power Platform or Dynamics 365, take a look at how this BPM tool can add value. You can find them at agilexrm.com or check out the show notes for more details. Welcome to the MVP Show. In this episode, I have Sheila Shapari joining me. She's been an MVP for some time. We cover some topics quite different today than what normally, you know, I talk about with MVPs. So I'd love you to take a listen, take to heart what we talk about, and ask yourself, what steps can I take? Based on what we're going to discuss, what steps can I take as an individual to be more proactive in the areas we discuss? Anyhow, sit back, listen to this episode. Full show notes can be found at nz365guy.com/239. Hey, Sheila, welcome to the MVP Show.
Hey.
Good to have you on the show. I thought that you would have been on well and truly before now, but obviously the stars haven't aligned, but you're on now.
Yeah, I think we've been trying to get this on the books for a while, but finally got it.
Awesome. So first up, who are you? Where are you from? Tell us a bit about your history, your origin story.
Oh boy, that's a loaded question. Sheila Shapari. I hail from the United States. I'm out of St. Louis, Missouri. It's right smack in the middle of the country. Many of you might be familiar with Ferguson, which is in our backyard. So very front and center to the whole social justice movement as of now. That's been a big focal area of mine for quite a while. Just a little tangent there. My day job is running an IT consulting firm. We are a digital agency focused in and around customer and employee experience, which is a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Basically, we specialize in the Microsoft Power Platform. We do a lot of CRM implementations, a lot of custom app implementations, a lot of big scale digital transformations. I guess it's a buzzword, agile transformations, where we transform industries into doing things based on low code infrastructures to get them to a lot more of an agile ecosystem. We do a bit of work with AI as well, where we help empower businesses into starting to develop predictive models and predictive analytics around how to make better decisions in whatever domain they might be. So that's kind of long and short of what we do from a day job perspective.
Where does the name Shapari come from? What's your ancestry there?
That would be a Persian last name. It's from Iran. Yep.
Very, very cool. I did not realize that about you. I've known you for some years, and you know, you hear somebody's name and you just don't think about it. But then I was like, Shapari, that's not a common one I've come across before.
Yeah, there's a few of us in the States, but yeah,
very cool. What do you do for play? Like, as in, when you're not working, when you're not focusing on the business side of things, what gives you pleasure and enjoyment in life?
Well, I spend a lot of time with friends and family. I actually just moved back to St. Louis, a smaller city. I was in Denver, Colorado for quite a while, and family and friends kind of magnetized me back to St. Louis. It has that effect on people. You'll notice a lot of retreads, as we call them, that come back to St. Louis for that very reason. We've got a lot of deep seated culture, a lot of cool stuff going on in the city. But I've spent a lot of time with friends and family, and then a lot of hobbies. I try to stay active. COVID has dampened that a little bit for me. But I'm pretty active in hiking and running and all those kind of things. And then I'm also a musician by trade. Used to do that for a profession in a former life. Now I'm more of a hobbyist with it. So that's pretty busy life.
So you've done an album, right? You're like you're a singer, and do you play instruments as well?
Yeah. I studied classical piano in school. Was a competitive pianist for quite a while. I still think that even consulting is a stressful industry. I will say that, but nothing to this day has been more stressful than competitive piano. That is a very stressful life. I always draw the analogy of it being like studying for 6 months for this, you know, high pressure certification or big bar exam or something like that. And then imagine that you have no backspaces, no erasers. You have a very finite amount of time that you're able to do whatever it is you're studying for. And then on top of that, you have some of the top experts in your field looking over your shoulder, just analyzing every little thing you're doing, seeing how you perform. There's the competition aspects of it, of just the stress and all that. So still love music and all that, and I praise anybody that's able to hack it, because it's a stressful life when you're in that high stakes competitive. Some people just kind of thrive in that environment. I'm not one of those people, I don't think.
So did you write your own songs as well as music?
Yeah. I did. After I got out of the classical circuit, I moved into kind of a singer songwriter thing after college. I also did a bit of jazz studies, so I had a lot of good jazz musician friends. We formed a band. Did that for quite a while. I was in a Beatles tribute band for quite some time, and I've been all over the map. Yeah, still do songwriting here and there, just for my own personal thing.
To those listening, I have had the pleasure of hearing Sheila sing live in a bar, and heck, I think that was in New Orleans? No, Orlando. It might have been Orlando. It wasn't Orlando. It was. Oh my gosh, where was it when we were in the bar and you got up and sung?
I have no idea. All those conferences are a blur mark.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially when alcohol is flowing at that hour of the evening. I remember singing Journey with Sarah Zelenik. I think we sang Don't Stop Believing. That was quite at the end. It was with Gus Gonzalez. I can't remember what song it was.
It was definitely an American city, but I can't remember. You're right; they become a blur. Tell us about social justice. You just mentioned that there in your intro, and I have noticed recently more of your posts on social media. Tell us, educate us.
Yeah, so I've been a more silent proponent to the cause for many years, growing up with the diverse background that I personally have, and then having a high plethora of friends and people I consider family that are people of color and of other kind of minorities. And it's a very near and dear cause to my especially having Ferguson be front and center of that. I think everybody in the world kind of awakened to the reality of our situation after the George Floyd incident. And I personally, among many others, kind of took that to be a point of no more. I'm drawing a line. Anything that I used to shy away from for political reasons, I do not feel are no longer political issues. I feel like they are human rights issues. They always were. I think us as privileged folks, we have the privilege of shying away from uncomfortable things more easily than people who don't. My minority statuses can hide in plain sight because I don't present with them. Other individuals are not afforded that privilege. So just making sure to have voices heard that aren't getting heard, and also just educating myself into even you know, my own elements of growth that I've needed to do on my own personally, because again, you know, whatever elements of privilege that I've had and not having to really dive into the nitty gritty of things. So been on a journey of my own through all of that, been aligning with a lot of the organizations that are based out of St. Louis in that regard, and just trying to find ways to start helping in whatever way I can. Our organization, Purita Group, we heavily focus in on nonprofit. We always have. And it's kind of gotten to a point where all the stars are starting to align, and that, you know, there's these big cause driven organizations with human rights or with just the fundamental needs that, you know, the UN and all of these other organizations have already well established. None of this stuff is new, right? And then that's kind of the interesting part is, yeah, these things are not new. A lot of us getting awoken to these things aren't living the experiences of hundreds and hundreds of years that, you know, and white saviors and things like that, where people just think, oh, I'm going to come in and fix 400 years of tyranny or whatever that situation is. It's not as simple as that. So, you know, figuring out the little drop in the ocean that you can make to try and trickle out whatever positive impacts you can, is kind of where I am at this point.
I like it. As in, my wife and I were having a discussion yesterday, might have been, or the day before, around, you know, it's no longer acceptable for those in the non-minority groups to sit by and not take a proactive action. And she, one of the things she said, like in the women's suffrage movement before women had the right to vote, and it's interesting, in New Zealand was, I think, the first country in the world where women were given the right to vote. And no matter how much women tried to represent themselves at that time, they did not have the legal right to vote. So it actually took people that did have the power to make change. In that case, the male lawmakers had to actually change the law and empower women to vote. And if we fast forward to today, and where we are particularly at the moment focusing on Black Lives Matter, a lot of people that have lived for generations from a privileged point of view have to really now, I think, as we become more educated and have a deeper understanding of what other groups have actually been through, it's on us to be proactive, to address these and not go, well, it doesn't affect my sphere and therefore I'm staying out of it. Like you said, it's not a political thing. It's a human rights issue. We need to engage. How to, you know, in the environment we're in, how do white folk, if you like, that have come from a privileged background, that don't understand the other side, or have not had no kind of upbringing, educational reference, or sometimes just choose to live in ignorance of how other people have been treated generationally, how do they, one, start to proactively educate themselves, and then two, take proactive action? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so a close friend of mine, she teaches social justice at a local university in the area, and she teaches to people of privilege overall. And she was mentioning to me how unique of a time this is, because all of the books that she references in her curriculum are sold out right now, right? So there's no shortage of material. There are staple books that everybody kind of mentions. One comes to mind, it's called White Fragility. A lot of podcasts, no shortage of material. I think that the main thing to understand and the nuances that come into play here are that, especially as white folk, we need to, and I'm in a weird place because I'm Middle Eastern and it's kind of a fuzzy white, but I present as white, so I say I'm white. Kind of brown, kind of white, and in between. Anyway, there are there are a lot of social groups that have formed over many years. So yeah, there's been ones, a lot of them stemmed out of the Ferguson movement, and a lot of things to really get people to understand what the concept of being white really is, and not to shy away from it as we do, because it's uncomfortable for people to identify as white. A lot of people, you know, feel kind of that guilt and that shame, and we don't want to comment on constructs of racism because we don't want to be identified as a racist. All of these things that we are uncomfortable with. The key point that I've been educated on, and I'm still very early on my journey and working through it, is just listening and understanding, especially with a demographic that has gone through centuries of abuse and just, you know, horrible degradations and all those things. Their job is not to educate us, right? We have the materials. We have Google. We have resources. We can educate ourselves with everything that has happened through history, the real history, not necessarily what was taught in our United States upbringing. I remember reading Howard Zinn's People History of the United States back in college, and that was like this crazy leftist, you know, situation where, oh no, we can't put this tarnished history on our precious country. But if it's really what really happened versus what they teach you in history books, or all of this erasure that happened with Native Americans and all these other elements, then, you know, that's something to come to terms with and, you know, own up to and move forward together, right? So that's what we're seeing, a lot more consensus around that. We still got a very politically charged country, as you know, but I really firmly believe that the majority of individuals are coming to that kind of common ground at this point, as long as we don't muff it up with the wrong branding or whatever anybody's gonna do to detract from what the reality is, right? Because that's what we like to do as Americans, is turn everything into a political sideshow, basically.
It's interesting, and I don't think I have the authority to speak on it, but one observation I've made with the whole, you know, the police side of things, where, you know, where a police officer does something that, you know, is clearly racist, you've got to ask, what is the culture of that police force? Is that a lone ranger individual, or is it actually, a cultural, you know, codified in, if you like, to those kind of organizations? And that is just the outworking of it. And that's what my biggest concern is that sometimes I feel it's not necessarily just individuals, but it's a culture that's been built into agencies and stuff over generations again. And it happens that the focus point is the outcome of individuals, but you got to go back to, what is the culture of being taught inside some of these organizations that individuals feel that they have the right to act the way they do?
Yeah. Number one, I'll send you the link. I can't remember the name of it. I just started a podcast that goes through the history of policing through like ancient history with Spartan Empire and things like that. It's pretty enlightening. I'll send you a link to that. I can't remember the name of it, but my first job was working for a nonprofit that serviced local and state police departments, among other, you know, government agencies such as, you know, courts and jail systems and all of that. And I worked directly with police officers. I have a lot of, you know, friends that are police officers. There's a lot of servitude that should not go, understated, right? There's the level of risk, the level of sacrifice, for a profession that, you know, a lot of times does go unrewarded, right? To volunteer into a profession where you want to help people is, that in an environment where you might not get rewarded. I mean, if you're a consultant, you kind of have a little similar of a role there, but nothing to that regard, right? Nothing to that. So with that, there's that aspect. Does that mean that there aren't cultural issues at play? No. Does that mean that there aren't brotherhoods that form? Because if you're in the throes of battle, as many of these individuals might take it, because you're in, high crime areas where you're continuously de-escalating things through the way you've been trained, and maybe those trainings aren't actually solving the problem. Maybe they're escalating the problem. All of these things that cause further unrest and distrust in the system, and the fact that Black folks have to train their kids at a young age on how they have to interact with police officials for their own safety is just so counterintuitive and anti what the whole premise is supposed to be and what we're told. But again, as a person who can present white, it's a completely different experience where you seek help from an official versus that kind of thing. And I think that's not to diminish, the systems in place, but I keep telling people I was in these systems. There was a software, I don't know if it was formally called this or not, but it was called racial profiling. It was the name, and this was 2005. So that was a police software that they used to capture demographic data around specific individuals. And I don't. That we're not talking about the 70s, 60s, 50s, 40s, 30s. We're talking about 2005. So, that institution of, you see it you see it in healthcare as well, where you feel like in high stakes situations, the whole political correctness, quote unquote, it's not the highest priority, right? You're saving lives. So we have to take these shortcuts that are still socially acceptable in those scenarios, right? It's okay to shoot to kill if your life is threatened. It's okay to make cognitive shortcuts about somebody based on race if their life is in danger, where you might not do that in a normal situation, because there's all those other things to think about. So it's a complex situation. And what at least we're able to have a dialogue about it now.
And I think that's probably one of the hardest things is to have the dialogue because people don't want to expose their ignorance to some degree and then get threatened with the concept of, as in being called a racist because of their ignorance. I read a book at the start of this year. It was published September last year by Malcolm Gladwell. So it's his most recent book called Talking to Strangers. And I don't know if you've read that, but a part of the book centers around a lady that was pulled over by a police officer, a black lady, and who then committed suicide 3 days later in her cell. And I tell you, this book is amazing because it's all around that. Looking at the other people, the strangers as it's told, right? That you don't know, that you don't have context of where they're coming from and how you can belligerently run in, judge a situation without really any of the context you'd truly need to understand where the other person is coming from. And I think it's well worth the read. Hey, this has been an interesting topic. We've actually already blown our time. We've not talked about anything MVP-ish and everything. But I think that's cool. And I have enjoyed talking to you. Any tips? We will do one MVP thing to wrap up with. Any tips from your years of being an MVP to aspiring MVPs out there, any advice that you'd give them?
You probably get this a lot, but it's really from my perspective, and I don't claim to be an expert. Every year I'm wondering how I got renewed, to be honest. But that being said, I it, it the getting back to, you know, servitude and really trying to give back to the community with whatever platform you are most comfortable in doing that. When I first started community outreach, I thought that an MVP was somebody who wrote a bunch of blog posts or was on a forum all day long. I didn't realize that there were other mechanisms that were able to be measured and granted an MVP token through events or through community outreach or all these other things. Again, with the world as it stands, you know, I'm hearkening on numerous individuals to use their skill sets for good, right? And all of that stuff is MVP measurable. MVP status is all about the reach that you're able to make. So being able to leverage Microsoft technologies to do good, especially in these uncertain times, that's an area that I'm focused in on because we don't have all of our conferences to go to and all of that right now. So trying to do what I'm doing already and then try to get some MVP involvement on top of that. But yeah, it's not really about striving for MVP. The ones that I can tell are about to get awarded are when you're like, you're not an MVP? I thought you were an MVP because you're so active that I just assumed it. And then, you know, they get awarded the next cycle. You see the ones that are like, I want MVP. Yeah, maybe they'll get it for a year or something, but it's not probably going to be a long-term thing because if it's not your natural desire to do what we do, then it's, you know, it's not going to be a sustainable thing.
Cool, man. Well, it's been good talking to you. I always like to wrap up with some quick-fire questions. Are you ready for yours?
Okay, let's go.
Okay, here's your first one. What's the wildest party you've ever been to?
I went to this one party many, many years ago that a friend hosted, and it was like a circus, and this guy had cut out the center of his house to be like this open entry thing, and they had like ribbon dancers and a foam pit and all this crazy stuff. I felt like I was in a movie. It was pretty nuts.
Wow, nuts. Would you rather give up your smartphone or your computer?
Probably smartphone.
Okay. What's your most used emoji?
Cry face, probably.
If you could never work again, how would you spend your time?
Volunteering. I don't think I could ever not work anyway. Do something.
Yeah. What's the most illegal thing you've done?
I can't answer that, Mark.
I love it. Because what that tells me, there have been illegal things. That is awesome. What do the last 30 minutes of your typical day look like?
Usually reading or watching TV, trying to unwind from what is usually a pretty busy day. Just trying to, sometimes glass of wine's involved. Depends on the day.
Nice. Fair call, Sheila. It's been great to have you on the show. If people want to connect with you online, where's the best place for them to do that?
Probably on LinkedIn. Just look me up. I'm on like Twitter, but I don't really go on there. That's kind of a joke because I still have like old music profile stuff on there and I never go on there. So whenever I get asked this question, I'm like, oh, I should probably put more effort into social media presence. But I have a LinkedIn with my name, Sheila Shapari. So probably the easiest way to find me or at my email, Sheila@paritagroup.com.
Hey, thanks for listening. I hope you found that challenging. I know it was different than what we normally cover, but I would love for you to, one, become more educated, two, look at the way you are brought up and don't just accept it as that's the way you should live going forward. You know, we all have grown up with some form of bias in our upbringing, to some degree, not just by nature of being human. And sometimes once we know a clearer truth, we need to put aside, if you like, the lies of the past, the lies of sometimes some of the things that come up or are part of upbringing, and really have to make our own cognitive choices and decisions going forward, and how are we going to act in the cultural environment we live in today. The world is constantly changing now more than ever, and we all need to play our part. Full show notes can be found at nz365guy.com/239. See you next week.